Hey folks, I just wanted to stop in before we roll into this week's episode and give you a little bit of a trigger warning. This week we're going to be discussing self-harm as well as suicide. So if that is something that you are sensitive to, I definitely would skip this episode. Regardless, thank you so much for listening and for your continued support. Because of that support, we're able to share stories like the one that we are going to share today. So with that, we are just going to roll right into this week's episode. Thank you again.
Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Pilots Pandemic Podcast. You're here with your host, Emma, and our lovely co-host, Maddie.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Hello.
So this week we are joined by a guest, John Dvorak. Did I remember correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Very good.
Yeah. So if you just want to give yourself a little bit of an introduction, John.
Well, I am a pilot technically on medical for a major U.S. airline, and I'm just about to turn 64, and been in aviation for my entire life. I started out going to a university program for aviation, got most of my ratings there, and then went on to the flight instructor era, and the fueling airplanes, degreasing bellies and things like that, de-icing. Also as a CSA, I got a job with a commuter airline, and I actually worked on the ramp there and at the ticket counter and in the air freight section. And so I've done a lot of different jobs at the beginning of my career. So I'm familiar with what goes on all around the operation. And then I actually got a flying job with that same commuter airline, and ended up staying there 5.5 years and upgraded to a captain on a FH-227, which is an older airplane. There's none of them flying anymore. It's a high wing turboprop, about 48 passengers. And that company ended up being bought, and ended up with Continental Express in Cleveland. And then stayed there for a bit flying the Brasilia. And then went to Midway Airlines, which is a jet carrier out of Chicago Midway Airport back in the 80s and 90s, and they actually went out of business in 91, and then I was off flying for about a year and a half. Went back and finished my degree. And then got picked up by 737 carrier, and stayed there. I've been there ever since. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, right there. So,
Awesome. So quite the background in aviation flying for many years. And just for our audience, how we got connected with John is through our friend Jamie Drain, who was on our podcast a while back, I think a few months back. But she connected us with John because you had been friends with her husband, James. So thank you, Jamie, for helping us connect with you, John. And then one of the first questions I asked, I know you had kind of went over all of your aviation career, but who was the person or thing that really ignited your passion in aviation?
Is from an early age. I grew up in the Chicago area and happened to live under the approach path for O'Hare, and I was noticing airplanes every 30 seconds go over my house, and I just was fascinated by the size of them and the noise they made. And then my dad bought a plastic model of a Pan Am 707, and so he helped me put that together. And then he took me on a business trip with him. I think it was to Detroit, my first airplane ride, and I got to see the cockpit, and it just kind of grew on me, and that's what I always wanted to do. It happened at an early age.
Seems like how it goes for a lot of folks that we speak to. It's always something that's like starts from a very young age. You have that interest. But what was it like being an airline pilot in the early 2000s? And what were some of the stressors that you dealt with that you didn't think about before becoming an airline pilot?
The big one, early 2000s, had to be 9/11, and all the security mandates and procedures that came after that. When I started in this career, flight crew didn't even have to go through security. I mean, there was minimal security for passengers, and people could go down to the gate and see off their friends and relatives, and then that changed. But flight crew was still able to just walk through the exit and go to the airplane. And so after 9/11, that all changed. With the having to just to go through security ourselves, and things were changing literally daily. I mean, you'd get a new we call them read before flies, or notices that something had changed. So that was a huge thing that I certainly didn't anticipate when I got into the business. I was married at the time, and my wife, she was a flight attendant as well for another airline. I came home from a trip after 9/11, and her supervisor was in our living room talking with her. I mean, that was it really hit my wife hard, because she knew a couple of the flight attendants on the American plane that went into the World Trade Center. So she really took that hard, and it was hard to see her in that stressful situation. But she took a little bit of time off after that, and when flying did resume, I had a trip. The first day flying resumed, I think it was on a Friday, and it was just surreal going to the airport. And I remember the one day, that first day, there was a security breach, so everyone had to exit again and go back through, and it was just chaotic. And the first leg I did had zero passengers on it, and the next leg, I think it was from St. Louis to Cleveland, I think we might have had two or three people on that flight. And then and so it was a time that was very we weren't really sure what was going to happen, you know, with the country, not just the airline, but the whole country itself, you know, what was going to happen. And I remember on that trip, taking off out of Albany, heading south towards, I think it was somewhere in Florida. And you could still see the smoke from the Twin Towers coming up off from Manhattan there. So, yeah, that was it was just a time of uncertainty
in
the industry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It seems a lot like when you talk about 9/11, because I think I was about in third grade when 9/11 happened. I'm really dating myself. Mm-hmm. But it just seems very similar or reminiscent of COVID times, like with the mm-hmm. unknowing, the not knowing if you are even going to fly again and being furloughed. And obviously we've seen 180 with the system and the industry turning back around, and it is a lot like 9/11 in that way. But it also reminds me of Emma's dad, because he was working at that time, and she had said that he had put in some zip ties into his hat, and it was like, you don't think about that now because of how solid security is for the most part, but back then, I'm sure there was that that thought in the back of your mind, like, oh, like there could be a hijacker on this plane, which is insane to me to even have to think about. So thank you for right. sharing that.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't, back then there were, you know, we didn't have the secure doors yet. And mm-hmm. so things were still, it was still a porous environment. And, you know, there were armed U.S. soldiers in our domestic airports, you know, with in full battle gear. It was something, you know, that we you know, normally wouldn't see. And
it's definitely a stressful or situational stressor, as I like to call them. Mm-hmm. But I know that you had other triggering stressful events in your life that we had spoken about in our previous phone call, and one of those had triggered you into kind of like a depression, which was your divorce. And I kind of wanted you to share with us what that was like and how that affected you and the mindset it might have spiraled you into.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even going back further, I think the seeds for depression may have been planted, you know, at an early age. You know, growing up, you know, our family, you know, we weren't rich, and there were financial struggles. And I had my father was absent from about age 10, and so I think there was just a lot of stressors surrounding that that helped contribute to later on in life. I was married for it was about 20 years when things started to unravel. I, you know, when we get married, there's no manual for that. So we're kind of winging it based on our what we've observed. Whatever our role model were for that, and sometimes that isn't always a healthy thing. So I we didn't have kids, and I think, you know, it was hard to keep this spark going. And you know, I dealt with perfectionism, and that's and it wasn't always fair to her. And I started to wonder whether I wanted to be married. I struggled with that, my own personal battles with that. And I'm not trying to place blame on my parents or my wife, but whatever happens does have an effect on you. And I also lost three friends in rapid succession, you know, two to cancer and one in a tragic drowning accident. And And I allowed myself to get involved in some emotional affairs, you know, trying to find, you know, what I thought was happiness, even though it was right there within my marriage if I was smart enough to see it. But it did lead to a separation. And I was feeling, you know, because I was, my mind was other places as well. I was feeling burned out, with life. I ended up being diagnosed with sleep apnea, which I still treat with a CPAP machine. And so I was tired a lot, and that led to irritability and just an all around a bad situation in the marriage. And we ended up separating. And then I found out, you know, found some things, you know, that that concerned me. And I wanted to put the marriage back together. It was too late for that. She had met somebody, and that really hit me very hard. I remember it was like a switch went off inside of me when I, you know, it changed my whole outlook. I just felt overwhelmed, and I started to go into a dark place, and was starting to lose hope. I should back up a bit. I had already taken myself off the line, so I was already you know, seeing a therapist and a doctor for the depression. So in that environment, there's not a whole lot of, I shouldn't say, I mean, there isn't, they treat airlines, and I can speak for mine, but I don't know about the others, but they don't treat it as a disease per se. They separate it out into something different. It's not like if a guy has a heart attack, you know, he doesn't lose his disability payments. But when you are out on a mental, what they call a mental illness case, they put a time limit on how quickly you can should become that you should become coming back to work, and they remove all your benefits, even for other medical conditions. They take away your travel benefits, they take away your insurance. So there's, you're virtually left with nothing, other than your seniority number. And in my case, I didn't even have, you know, the disability payments only last for 18 months, and then they take that away. So that just adds additional stressors to everything. And you start to lose, you feel alone, and you start to lose hope. You feel abandoned by the company. I should say also that, you know, I'll get to that later, but, you feel like you don't measure up anymore. You feel less than, and defective, if you will. And you start to withdraw. At least in my case, I withdrew. I didn't know where to turn anymore for any help, who to call.
I can imagine it's also difficult because I know for a lot of aviators that flying is, you know, it's an identity, but it's also for a lot of folks, it's a passion, and it's a lot of times the one place that they feel really whole and happy. I know for some people also it can be an additional stressor, but I can imagine that adds just another compounding level. But I can definitely resonate with that, watching my dad go through everything that he went through, which was for heart health issues. But a lot of those similar feelings, I think, came with his experience as well. But can you share with us, if you feel comfortable doing so, could you share with us and our audience where that dark place took you?
Yeah, it got me thinking that there was, I didn't know what the future would hold. There was a feeling of a fear of the unknown, knowing that I was losing my marriage, and because of that, we were going to have to sell the house, and knowing that I was, you know, losing my medical, my ability to, you know, to have an income with flying. And so I started to feel like there was no way out. And so that's when I started to consider that maybe it'd be better if I just wasn't here anymore. And so I thought about taking my life, and actually did make an attempt. I don't know if you want to get me to get into the details of what happened, what I did, but yeah, I had an attempt. I took an attempt on my life, but I survived. It was actually, I'll be honest, it was, I used the exhaust in the garage. But I woke up. I fell asleep, but I woke up, and that was, you know, a couple of times that afternoon, and I think that there had to be somebody watching over me, because you know, everything I, you know, about that is it can kill you, and it didn't. So I do believe that there was somebody, you know, watching over me that day. So then the next day I got a, since the exhaust didn't work, I got a knife, and I walked down to a riverbank, and sat there and then started to cut myself. And I couldn't bring myself to, you know, to make the real, I don't know how to phrase it, but it hurt too much. But I was in such mental pain, but the physical pain, I just couldn't go through with it. But I was bleeding, and at that point I did reach out to my brother, and you know, told him what had happened. And then my sister and her husband came and found me, and they did take me to the hospital. So that was my first time in a hospital. The hospital that I went to for the emergency room didn't have any openings in their psych ward. So they took me to a different place. Which wasn't very nice. The facilities were kind of shabby, and there was, I don't want to judge anybody, but I believe that there were people there that were in there for severe substance abuse, and I didn't really feel safe there. I asked to get out, and so they did let me out after 3 days with the concurrence of my family, and so I went back home. By this time, I mentioned that before, we were separated, so I was going back to an empty house, and it was it was a very very cold place. I ended up starting to not take care of, you know, activities of daily living. I would get up in the morning and I would get on my bike and I would ride 18 miles without stopping. And then I would come home and pace the whole house. You know, it was this unusual behavior, up and down the second floor, down to the basement. And it was just, it wasn't a life. My diet was poor. I lost a lot of weight. And so then a few months later, I was just still in a state of depression. And I tried cutting myself again, and this time it was a little bit worse. But obviously I survived, which I'm thankful for, and ended up at another facility, the emergency room that I was at before. They actually had room at that hospital this time, so I stayed there for about 5 days, and a little bit nicer facility. I don't really think I got better in either of those places. It's very dehumanizing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, John, because you've said that a few times now, like your experience after your attempts, and I'm believing in your story, like that this was the last attempt that you made, right? So when you went to this this psych ward, like what was so dehumanizing about it? Like what were the bad parts about it, or why you didn't feel it really helped you in your recovery?
I think it's partly just you're confined to a very small space. You don't have a lot of, there's your bedroom, the hallway, and a common room, if you will, and maybe a few workshop rooms, and the activities that they put you through are very almost, I want to say, childlike. Some of the exercises that you do, you know, it's there's not a lot of individual interaction. You're in there with other people, and they have varying levels of depression or mental illness. It's hard to really see, you know, what they're trying to accomplish there. It's almost like you're just a caged animal. And you know, you stay in there, and when insurance says you're done, you get out. I just didn't really feel like that was being helped much there, until, and this is a segue into the last visit. Later on that summer, we were having, you know, we're getting ready to sell the house, and there were things that needed to be done, and I still wasn't functioning, you know, 100%, or even probably even 50%. And my wife asked me to do something related to us selling the house. I believe it was a phone call or something, and I just couldn't bring myself to accomplish the task. And she kept calling back and asking if I had done it, and I said no. And I should say, she was, even though we were getting a divorce, she was very helpful through my whole process of my hospital visits. She was there for me, and you know, she helped me out a lot. So anyway, she called my psychiatrist and told her that I was that I just wasn't myself. And so my psychiatrist told her to and check myself into the hospital that she recommended and a specific doctor that she wanted me to see, who was a very well-known, or at least a psychopharmacologist, I guess that's the term. And she wanted me to see him. So I did check myself into that last facility, which was very nice. It was a much cleaner, modern facility, and she described it as people that were a little functioning at a higher level than maybe some of the places I was at before, and I was there for 11 days. Again, I don't believe that the workshops or any of the activities were what got me better. I think it was the combination of meds, I think, that they put me on that eventually was able to start changing my brain chemistry and getting me to think clearer.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, what helped you turn your life around and gave you that different outlook? Was it anything besides medication, or was that really the push that you needed to kind of turn it all around?
No, there was the medication. It's hard to quantify, you know, how that helped, or if I'm sure it did, but it's hard to measure that. At least for me, I don't know. You know how that affected me, but I'm pretty sure it did in a positive way. But I think it was more internal for me. I think I knew I didn't ever want to go back to. I decided I never wanted to go see the inside of a psych ward again, and I just I made a personal decision to change my outlook. And try to really get better. It as we got closer, you know, to selling the house, I didn't know, you know, where I was going to go, but my family decided that I shouldn't be living alone. So fortunately, my brother took me in, so that took a stressor away that I was going to have a place to live, and. I did receive one big disability payout, and we made a little money on the house, and then there was some money that we had in investments and savings that we cashed in, and so that took some of the financial stressors off of me. So it allowed me to just focus on myself and make the conscious decision that I was going to get better from this. I didn't know what that would look like, but I just knew I wasn't going to go back into a psych ward again. And so I spent a lot of time out in nature. I would walk in forest preserves and woods and listen to music with my headphones while I was walking or even running at times. And then I started traveling again. So that helped me get out into society and, you know, have some joy in my life. So every day I just added, you know, a little bit more activities and a little more joy and happiness, things that made me happy. And I began to reach out again to my friends. I really withdrew for that period of time, which is, you know, it was one bad summer out of all my years of living. That's the thing that's really, I know we'll get into this later, but I had one bad summer of my entire life, and it's kind of, in the case of the FAA, it's defined my whole existence. But yeah, I just I it was more of an internal conscious choice to get better. And
so really no like one thing that had triggered you, but kind of like, I guess, like a mountain of things that happened that helped you move past that dark summer that you had. But I wanted to ask you another question because of like the events that occurred with the attempts on your life. Your medical was revoked, but you were determined to try to get it back. You went through your union advisory and also utilized the Mayo Clinic services. So can you share with our audience what that was like for you, like how much time it took, the money that you spent, and then the promise, or kind of like imaginary promise, I guess, of you maybe getting your medical back and how that went for you?
Well, it didn't do it immediately because I was still, you know, getting myself healthy. So about a year and a half, maybe 2 years after dark summer, I wanted to try to get my medical back. So our union contracts with an aeromedical doctor. He's not he doesn't work for our union, but he's contracted through our union to help pilots that are on medical, that are trying to get their medicals back with the FAA. So he's kind of like a liaison. He advises, you know, pilots on what they need to do, the steps they need to take as far as paperwork goes and things like that. So I did contact him, and recommended I see a forensic psychiatrist, which I did at my own expense. He reviewed, I think I saw him two or three times, and, you know, we got my records, medical records from the FAA in Oklahoma City, and in conjunction with the aeromedical advisor, they felt that it was maybe too soon after my attempts to proceed with getting my medical back. So I went back to, you know, just trying to get myself better, and fast forward to about 2019, I decided I'm going to make this attempt to get my medical back. And I knew it was a daunting task because my case was very complex. And with the advice of the aeromedical advisor, he knew a doctor that was at the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic has an aerospace medicine department, and so I made contact with them and set up an appointment to go through their aerospace medical department with the goal of getting my first class medical back. And I visited the Mayo Clinic I think two or three times. So I incurred the expense of driving up there and hotels, and they gave me some cognitive tests and interviews with doctors and physicals, psychiatrists, just the whole gamut of things, and they put together, you know, a package to send to the FAA, and we sent that off, and they said, you know, that the FAA has these panels of people that review cases like this that might take a few months, but the rejection letter came fairly quickly. I was actually surprised how fast it came, and it was a final determination that I wasn't eligible to hold a first class medical, or even a second or third class medical. I felt pretty defeated, but at least I had tried everything I could in my own mind, you know, satisfy myself that I had done everything I could to try to get my medical back. So,
yeah, I think one of the interesting parts that you had mentioned to me in our previous phone call is that, well, one being that no one ever told you that you wouldn't get your medical back, which is surprising to me because they say that clearly, usually now, at least if you have a suicide attempt, they typically say that you're not allowed to get your medical back. But also with all the medications as well that you had explained, which we didn't really go over today, but that's okay. But just, you know, no one pointing out like, oh, these medications are disqualifying. And I think
nobody tells you that at the beginning. Yeah. These are certain medications that you can't take. And part of that is the medical community is not well versed in aviation matters, mm-hmm. except if you're in aerospace medicine. But you know, a regular psychiatrist or medical doctor doesn't really know that these restrictions exist. And I know there are four antidepressants that are now approved that pilots can take, you know, while they're flying. But I needed more than that, obviously. And so another rule that the FAA has is that a red flag for them is if you're treated by more than one psychotropic drug concurrently. So when I came out of the hospital the last time, I was on five different medications. And so that's a red flag for them, which I didn't know going in. But the thing is that that's what the doctor determined would help me. So I don't understand the FAA's thinking as to why they would restrict, you know, the use of medications if it's going to help you. And, you know, right now I'm not on any medications. I've gotten, with the help of my doctor, I have gotten myself off of all medications. So the FAA has some pretty strict, and I'm not sure I understand their thinking, you know, why they restrict a medication that's going to help you get better. That's baffling to me.
We totally agree with you on that. That's our thinking too, is like, well, if your doctor says this is going to help you, then why is the FAA has a whole different thought process on those things? And in reality, for me, I feel as if the FAA is just, you know, that regulatory body. They're not really there for your wellness. They're there just for rulemaking. And right now those rules don't really, you know, meet the eye. They don't make sense. So
mm-hmm. You're not seen as an individual in the eyes of the FAA. You're just seen as a case, and they kind of just lump them all together, I think, even though they say they don't. But I mean, I was willing to be a test case. I was willing to be monitored. I would, you know, the one thing you don't get to do is talk to anybody in the FAA. You're kind of, there's a barrier there. I mean, I would have gladly gone to Oklahoma City myself and met with their doctors, just so, you know, they could see me as a person. My own personal doctor, whatever she wrote on her notes, you know, she cleared me in her eyes. I mean, she's not versed in aviation matters, but in her eyes as a person, I was well enough that she was willing to write that I was, you know, fine. The thing with the FAA is your own doctor's reports don't even matter to them. They do their own thing, you know, even though you send them all the information, it doesn't weigh with them. And that has to change, I think, that they make that one determination on their own without really, I don't believe they take the time to look at each individual person and what their doctor has said. So
It's definitely super frustrating, and we hear that from literally every single one of our guests who's gone down the SI pathway. They all say that. And it's just, I don't know, very frustrating. And I, every single time we come upon this subject, I wish I had a better thing to say, but there is really no other word besides frustrating and just inadequate, archaic. It's just, I could go on, but what was the most difficult part of knowing that you weren't ever going to be able to fly again?
Well, I think, you know, one, we tend to identify ourselves with our jobs sometimes. And so having to try to look at myself as just a person that, you know, I that's what I did for a living, but being a pilot didn't define me. So I had to accept the fact that the decision that, you know, the FAA handed down was that's what I had to work with. And you know, I wasn't able, I had to come to terms with not being able to do what I was trained for. You know, I knew I missed seeing people that I, you know, worked with and seeing friends, at work, you know, sometimes you'll be, you know, walking down the terminal and you might see somebody that you haven't seen for 5 or 6 years, you know, and you catch up just like it was yesterday, and then you might not see them again for a couple of years. But so I just missed the camaraderie of being part of the bigger group. So that's probably the hardest thing, but
definitely.
One of the things that helped me though was I was never a big social media person, but I did get on Facebook finally. Through my gym, I had an eating challenge, and one of the things we had to do was post pictures of our meals. So it kind of forced me to join Facebook, and then when I did, people started coming out of the woodwork, people that I hadn't heard from in years, so in that respect, Facebook has social media has allowed me to reconnect with people and actually meet some new people, new friends, and so I've been able to maintain a social life through that, and also just by doing activities with people, putting myself out there and being you know, active, and I've you know, that helped me develop a huge, you know, support network, which I didn't have before. And so I know that there's people, you know, if ever I needed help, there are people I can call at any time, and they'll be there for me. And
You can definitely get on board with the social media aspects, and that's how Emma and I met. And then we met Jamie Drain through social media as well. So we're all kind of connected through the social networks, which is awesome. But I had another question for you, because I know this has kind of been like a big roller coaster of life that you've been on, and you started in a really dark place, and now you're back on the other side. You've kind of done like a 180 from where you were. So does it kind of seem unreal, or like a dream, that you were in a totally different place 10 years ago? And the second part of that question is this: one of our listeners is struggling, has found themselves in a similar situation. What would you tell them?
So the first question, yes, it is surreal. I never thought that I would be in a situation like that. I thought at one time that, you know, people that tried to commit suicide were taking the easy way out. It was a coward's way. But now, having been there, I see that it really changes something's going on in your brain, and I can empathize with anybody who's struggling with things now. And so, yeah, it was surreal. I still sometimes shake my head as to how far I sank. But I think sometimes you have to hit rock bottom in order to affect change in your life. And I think I've out of this, I've become a much more calm individual, you know, easier on myself. I don't have the strong, you know, perfectionism component anymore. Allow myself to be more gentle with myself. As far as what I would tell someone is, first of all, life is beautiful. There's a lot to experience, and that again, being a pilot is not who you are. It's just what you do, you know, what you do for a living, and it doesn't define you. And I would to their friends and family, and I would encourage them to find a trusted friend, family member, and just share what they're going through. It's difficult. I didn't do it, but I wish I had. So I would tell someone that's struggling that they have to you know, surrender to what's going on in their mind and body, and really, you know, just reach out to somebody. And because there's always a solution to whatever you're going through. That's I found out that things don't always your future trip about bad things, you know, how things are going to be, and a lot of times they don't pan out in as bad a way that you kind of thought they would. So so just try to have hope. You know, reach out to people, even somebody who's not struggling. You know, get yourself a network of people that are really, that you can trust and that are very close to you and that you can talk to about anything. And so I think that would help anybody. Mm-hmm.
One of the most interesting parts about your story, John, is that you're a suicide survivor, and we really don't get to speak with survivors often. Would you be able to share with our audience why it is a unique experience surviving suicide and sometimes a lonely road?
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of help for support, you know, for people that have are surviving members of someone who committed suicide, family members, spouses. There seems to be a lot of support there, but I've yet to find you know, any support groups or people that have actually, in my case, you know, made an attempt and survived. And and then of course, you know, the question of why I'm not flying right now. You know, they ask, you know, because I when I went through all this, I was well before the mandatory retirement age. So you know, having to deal with that sometimes is you know, a touchy thing. You know, you don't know who what they're gonna think. There's still a lot of stigma around depression and mental illness and suicide. So it's kind of a difficult thing sometimes to answer that question with people that I don't know very well. But as I've shared my story with friends, even acquaintances, and then here today, with you, who I've never met, I found that I've never had anybody reject me. Everyone has been that I've told my story to has been empathetic, and I've actually found a lot of support. It's kind of cathartic to tell your story to people, and then I, surprisingly, I have found friends who have gone through similar things. But you know, when I've told my story, they say, "Wow, you know, I went through something similar," or maybe not as serious as mine, but they've struggled. And I think that, you know, sharing your story, you're never going to know who might hear your story that is out there, you know, struggling with something as well. And I think this, you know, it's like a little support, you know, you develop support groups just by telling your, you know, sharing your experience with people. So, you know, people are more willing to share their stories with you as well. So there shouldn't be, you know, there shouldn't be a stigma around it. People should be able to talk about it.
Yeah, definitely think that it is difficult for people to share a story that's so vulnerable like yours. So we're grateful that you were willing to share with us that story today, your story. And I think it has a major impact. Like Emma said, we don't talk to suicide survivors often. And just to be here today is like a blessing that you're even sitting here speaking with us in a totally different place in your life. And you got past that one terrible summer. And I really like that you also said a lot of times when you're struggling, you're thinking about worst case scenarios, and that those things don't always happen the way that you catastrophize them to be. And I think that was really important because even, you know, me not with a depression diagnosis, I have a tendency to do those same things, like catastrophize things and think, oh, well, what if this happens or what if this happens? And oftentimes they turn out better than I expected them to. So that was a great point of advice for our audience. And I'm just really grateful for you sharing and opening up to us and allowing us to see you and know you better.
Thank you. Yeah, it's if I can maybe just help even with one person that hears this that might be struggling, if it helps them to take a different path, then it's all worth it. I don't know how much luck we have with the FAA, but you know, it's a start. You know, we can just, you know, chip away at it a little bit at a time, and yeah. Hopefully they'll affect some change.
I think so. I think the more stories that we tell, the more people that will come forward to tell their stories. And what I know about stories is that they have a lot of energy and impact, and they are what cause change. So I really thank you for being willing to share, and thank you for taking the time with us today. But we're going to move on to some lighter, fun questions. We like to end our show with a little bit of fun. So these ones are mostly based around aviation. So first one for you, John, is what is your favorite legacy carrier? So the legacy carriers are Delta, United, American, Hawaiian, or Alaska.
Well, I have to go back to one that's not around anymore first, but it was Pan Am, I think, old days. Yeah, just the route system. I always liked the white hats, and just the whole aura around Pan Am. But as far as the ones that are around today, I'd have to say American and United probably equally there. They're the two. United is a hometown carrier from where I live, and American has a big presence. You know, here as well, and so yeah, those are the two I would probably say. Mm-hmm.
Those are good ones. I would say Pan Am if I ever flew on them, but I never got to experience that.
Yeah, I got to fly them once. Yeah, one time I got to fly them.
My husband is very obsessed with the golden age of travel, so he loves Pan Am. I don't know if you've ever seen the series, the Pan Am series. I don't remember if it's on Amazon Prime. I think it is, but it's really good. It only ran for one season.
Yep, I remember it. I did see it.
Did you watch it?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, it's great. So anyone out there, if you guys love Pan Am or Golden Age of Travel, definitely watch that series. Mm-hmm. Even though it's only one season, I thought they did like such a great job with it. But Emma, what about you? What's your favorite legacy carrier if you have to choose one?
I'd have to say American because of like just biased. the family history with US Airways and Piedmont and all of that. So definitely choosing American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm also biased. I have to choose Alaska because I'm from the West Coast. I worked for their sister company, Horizon. And that's where I met my husband, was at Horizon Airlines. So Alaska is my favorite legacy carrier.
Yeah.
Although I feel like Hawaiian, if they were here and had a bigger presence in the landlocked states, then I think Hawaiian would be up there for me, but I've only flown on them once inter island. They're pretty nice, honestly.
Yeah. I've flown on Alaska and I like them. They've always done a good job when I've flown with them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of loyalty here on the West Coast for Alaska Airlines, right. Especially in the state of Alaska itself. But they're all great. So Delta lost out on that one. No one picked up the so losers. Okay, so second question for you, John. If you're going to have to sit in a row, where are you going to pick, the window seat or the aisle seat?
Oh, definitely window seat, without question. I flying still fascinates me, and I just like to look out. I like to look out at the other airplanes when we're taxiing out, and I've always been fascinated by foreign tails. You know, if I see, you know, all these different airplanes from around the world, it you know, just fascinates me that, you know, they took off and they were thousands of miles away, and here they are, you know, sitting there. And so I like to look out even when we're flying. I hear people say there's nothing to see out there, but if you look out, you know, if you look out and you really put yourself, you can try to transform yourself down on the earth there, and you pick out little details, you know. And and I like to compare what I'm flying over with what I know about the map. I always studied maps when I was a kid. I still like maps, and so you know, I like geography, and so seeing things that I've seen on maps in person, I like to see that. So yeah, always a window seat, and also either before ahead or behind the wing, so that you actually see the ground. So
yes, I love that. No, I'm also a window seat girl, and I am the person, like, if you don't want the window open, don't sit next to me. The light doesn't bother me. I'll literally sleep with the window open.
Yeah.
I am someone who is always looking out of the window, and especially if my husband's flying. This last trip, it was cute because he did an announcement for me basically, but nobody knew it was for me. It was like our code language. He's like, if you look out over here to the left, we're flying over Minneapolis and we're flying over Lake Vermilion. Well, me and him had gone to Lake Vermilion 2 years ago. And he was literally just saying that for me. I'm sure all the passengers were like, what is Lake Vermilion? Like, why do we need to know about this? But I definitely love to look out, love to see anything on, even if it's just clouds, you can't even see the ground. I'm still love to look outside. So I'm right there with you on the loving the window seat.
Yeah.
Emma, are you a window seat girl or are you an aisle seat girl?
Oh, I'm going to have to hit y'all with some realism. Really depends on the duration of the flight. Because I have to use the potty. Okay. So if we're going international, sorry, I'll lean over you. I'll look out a couple of times. Preferably I'm sitting next to my mom so I can just like kind of, you know, I'm not intruding in anyone's space, but international, give me the aisle because I'm using the restroom. Okay. And I'm also going to the back to get myself a drink because I'm not waiting for them to come up and down the aisle. It's just too much. But if I'm going like a little, just like puddle jump, hour flight, 2 hour, 3 hour flight, definitely choosing the window seat.
Uh-huh. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm kind of the opposite. I can do aisle seats, or a middle seat on a shorter domestic flight, but international, I like to have that window seat because yeah. I'm going someplace I might not have been before, and I like to see. Going into London, and they were landing to the east, which they don't. It's most of the time they land to the west, and we came out of the clouds, and I was looking out my window, and we went right over Windsor Castle, and I had my phone camera up, and I was able to actually snap a picture going over Windsor Castle. Everyone else in the airplane had no clue.
Yeah. When we, I can't remember how many years ago it was, but we had a layover at London Heathrow. And when we were flying in, I got to see like, I don't even know what that big building is. It's like, it looks like an egg and there's a Ferris wheel. And then the London Bridge and all of that. I was like, oh my gosh. But yeah, I was younger then, but it's always interesting to see. When I was in Ireland in October, and when we flew out, I had a window seat, and we flew over essentially everything that we did the 2 weeks we were there. Which was also very interesting to see, but I did have a quite unique experience with the woman that I sat next to. She made me feel really bad about using the restroom. And I was like this is why I should have had the aisle seat.
Well, that's the thing though. You know, if you pick the aisle seat, and I know a lot of people like that. I mean, that's what you, if I do sit in the aisle seat, I expect that people are going to have to get up, and we all have to just get along in the airplane. And yes. And if you're in the middle seat, you know, you get the armrests.
That also just reminded me of, I was getting on board the other day. I think I was coming home from New York, and this lady needed to get into the window seat, but the aisle seat and the middle seat passengers wouldn't get up. They just kind of pushed their legs to the side. And I was like, I don't know how this lady's going to get in, because it wasn't even an exit row. But my personal self would have been like, I'm not squeezing past you. You need to get up. But she literally, she was like, okay, watch my butt. And she like shimmies by them. I was like, wow, I can't believe these people did not get up and she didn't make them. I've never had to do that to me, but I totally would have been like, get up. I'm not shimmying over you.
I don't understand the thinking behind, it easy. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it had to be the age. These people were a little bit younger, so I guess they didn't care, but not me. I would not volunteer for that. Okay. But moving on to last question, what is your favorite beverage on board a flight?
It's either water or black coffee. Yeah. I used to partake when I was married. You know, I was able to ride in business and first class a lot across the ocean or wherever, and they would just ply us with wine or beer, and I partook in a lot of that stuff. But you know, I just hated getting off the airplane and feeling like crap and not being able to sleep. So I rarely ever have an alcoholic drink on when I'm traveling. It's usually just water or coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel you. I typically will drink water on board. If I have not gotten a coffee before I get on the plane, I'll get one on the plane, but I'm trying not to, just because I know that they don't clean the filters on the plane. And so if I think about it too much, it really grosses me out. But if I get an alcoholic beverage, I typically will get a Bloody Mary with gin.
Uh-huh.
Very different. But I limit myself to two, because like you said, at a certain point, you drink too much in the air, you're not feeling so great when you get on the ground.
And it's dehydrating anyway to be up there. And
exactly. Emma,
I think it's funny you said Bloody Mary, because ever since I've been little, American has always had I want to say it's by the brand, like, I want to say it's TJ's or something like that. But they have a Bloody Mary mix. And obviously, when I was little, like, I wasn't mixing it with anything. I just really loved the salt. It's like salty juice. I have loved it ever since I was little, and it's like a staple piece for me now. Like, I'm not going to get that now that I'm 23. I'm able to drink, so I'll get, you know, a little shot of vodka with it now. But honestly, I could drink it by itself, and I know that's so strange. Like, a lot of people don't like tomato juice. I absolutely love tomato juice, and if it's flavored, even better.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, oddly specific, but that's what I like. And it has to be that one brand. And I've noticed recently, I feel like they changed the formula because it's not as salty, and it doesn't have, like, used to have a little bit of spice. It doesn't have it anymore. It's kind of plain.
Yeah.
But just a little thing. All right. Well, yep, that's my answer. So with that, I guess we will wrap up the end of this week's episode. John, thank you so much for joining us and being vulnerable and telling your story. I know it takes a lot of courage, and I really admire and respect you for that.
Thank you, Emma and Maddie. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
All right, y'all. Well, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. It helps us out very much. And as always, keep the blue side up and the brown side down. We'll speak to y'all next week.